Biblical Spiritual Formation was presented by Ron Julian on October 11, 2003 at the 2003 Oktoberfest Conference titled Reflections on Spiritual Formation. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
I know that it is after 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and you've been sitting and listening to a lot of stuff, so I recognize that it's something of a challenge on my part to hold your attention. I hope I'm up to the challenge. Honestly, don't feel too bad about yawning or anything like that at this point. I can take it. I'm tough. My task this afternoon is to wrap up our conference with a talk that we've called Biblical Spiritual Formation. When I started to put this talk together, I realized that there are really two questions implicit in this topic. The first one is obvious. What is genuine spiritual formation? But there is a second question implicit here as well. What does it mean to be genuinely biblical? After all, nobody who's teaching on Christian spirituality gets up and says, I'm now going to give my unbiblical perspective on spiritual formation. I just made this up. The Bible says one thing, but I have a different opinion on this. I mean, that's not how it works. You know that there are many different voices out there who would have different things to say on this topic. People who would not like some of the things that we've said here. People who would give you very different advice on what spiritual formation is all about than what we have said. And yet those people are quoting the same Bible that we would point to. So, how does this happen? How are we all standing up and saying, here is the biblical view of spiritual formation, and yet we're coming to different conclusions? So I have to address that a little bit. I mean, I want you to understand something of what it means to me for something to be biblical, so that you have a perspective from which to critique whether where we're coming from here or not is right. So, I want to try to clarify that a little bit as we go along, as I'm talking about this topic. There's quite a diversity as to how people approach the question of what it means to be biblical. Some people would basically say, look, the Bible says we should love God, love our neighbor, and believe in Jesus. That's pretty much what it boils down to. So, anything that does not contradict that, if it doesn't inspire me to hate God, hate my neighbor, and tell Jesus to get lost, then that's biblical. I can take that and work with that, because that will fit with the Bible as I understand it. So I can include in my spiritual practices things like mandalas and maze walks and all sorts of things that are spiritual, that people of all faiths recognize as promoting spirituality. But when I walk in the maze, I'm thinking about Jesus. And so that's biblical. That makes it biblical, because as long as I'm thinking about Jesus, that makes it biblical. On the other side of the spectrum is the approach that would say, basically, the Bible gives us very specific descriptions of exactly how everything should be. The way you pray is unbiblical, because when Jesus described two men praying, he said they were standing. You're sitting. That's an unbiblical way to pray. Paul says to raise your hands when you pray, but I don't see you raising your hands when you're praying. That's unbiblical. When you worship, you're using musical instruments, but there is no mention of musical instruments in the New Testament. So, if you use musical instruments, it's unbiblical. So, what we mean by unbiblical or biblical can run the gamut from it vaguely fits with the idea that I should believe in Jesus, down to, if the Bible doesn't specifically tell me I can do it, it's forbidden. So, when we ask the question, what is a biblical view of spiritual formation, what question are we asking? How would I know? How could I tell the difference between one that was biblical and one that was not? So this is the task I've set myself, and I find myself, now that I have set myself this task, wondering if it's too big a task to have set myself, but this is the task I set myself. I want to try to explore these two issues at the same time. I want to explore the question of what is a biblical view of spiritual formation, and a little bit at the same time of the question, how would I know? So we'll see. Obviously, in one talk at the end of a long conference, I cannot hope to be exhaustive. I can hope to be exhausting, probably, but not exhaustive. So I want to look at two examples, two places where the issue of what it means to be biblical and something of the picture of spiritual formation come together. And I'm hoping that these two examples together will help to make my points. The first example is the lesser point I want to make. The second one is where we really get to the heart of what this talk is about. But the first one I think is significant and important. It comes from chapter 9 of 1 Corinthians. I have used this example before. If any of you were around a couple years ago, a talk I gave at one of our October fusses, I referred to this. But I think it's instructive in several ways. In chapter 9 of 1 Corinthians, I have heard that chapter used to make an argument something like this. Paul, in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, says that he refused payment from the Corinthians. The argument goes then that this is an example of Paul practicing a spiritual discipline. And in particular, we could call it the discipline of poverty or frugality or something like that. He had a right, he says, to take the money, but he did not take it. Why did he do this? Well, he explains at the end of the chapter. He is like an athlete subjecting his body to hardships so that he can prepare himself to run the race. And so the conclusion that is drawn from this then is spiritual disciplines are like exercise. I choose to subject myself to various disciplines now so that I can build up my spiritual muscles and run the race later on. And in particular, we see Paul here saying that he practiced the spiritual discipline of voluntarily choosing not to be paid. He could have been paid, but he turned it down. That discipline is something ultimately that will make him stronger and promote holiness in his life later on, like an athlete exercising. And that's why he did it. Now, this sounds like a biblical argument. I mean, it's an argument right from a passage. Here is Paul explicitly saying that he practices the spiritual discipline of poverty or frugality or something like that as an exercise that will help him in the race to be holy. The problem I have here with this perspective is that it has largely ignored the context of 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and the specific argument that Paul is making. I think that Paul is actually saying something quite different to the Corinthians in this section. So let me illustrate for you what I'm talking about. The situation, as I understand it, is this. Some of those who think themselves spiritually sophisticated in Corinth have decided that it is okay to eat meat that is sacrificed to idols. Their argument is, look, we know there is no such thing as an idol, so what's the big deal? It's just meat. It doesn't matter whether it's been sacrificed to idols. There is no idol, so I can just eat it. Now, as far as that goes, Paul agrees with them. He agrees. There is no idol. It's just meat. When you eat meat, if nothing else is at stake, if there are no other issues involved, don't even ask whether it's been sacrificed to idols or not. It's no big deal. I agree. There are no idols. But Paul is very concerned about the way that these sophisticated believers are choosing to conduct themselves. How are they choosing to exercise their knowledge that they have the right to eat this meat? What they're doing is they're putting social pressure on other less mature believers, that is, believers who don't yet understand that there is no such thing as an idol. And these believers are convinced that it would be very wrong to eat this meat sacrificed to idols. If they were to do that, they would be condoning idolatry, even participating in idolatry. And they don't want to participate in idolatry. They know that that's bad. So they won't eat it. The Sophisticates are putting pressure on them to join them in eating the meat. So in essence, what is happening is they are pressuring them to violate their conscience. They are pressuring them to do what they believe is wrong. So Paul's concern in the situation is, yeah, the meat is no big deal, but whether a person obeys God is a very big deal. You Sophisticates here are being a stumbling block to these less mature believers. You're right in your theology. You understand that you have the freedom to eat that meat. But the impact you're having on them is that you're pressuring them to do what they believe is wrong. How can you make fun of them and look down on them when, after all, they are trying to avoid idolatry? That's why they're doing it. That's why they're not eating the meat. So, the question becomes, which is more important, your right and freedom to eat the meat or your brother's spiritual welfare? Paul's message to them is, look, we have many freedoms as Christians, but how I choose to exercise my freedom depends on my other values. I don't just have a freedom, I also value the truth of the gospel. I also have an obligation to love my brother. I have an obligation to think about the impact of my behavior on other people. So Christian freedom does not say to me, since I am free, therefore I can do it whenever I want. It is one of the things I take into account when I think about how am I going to conduct myself. And then Paul gives himself as an example, I would argue. And he says, look, I'm an apostle and I have a right to be paid. You guys really have an obligation before God to support those who minister to you. It would be appropriate for me. There would have been nothing wrong for me to take financial support from you, and it would have been perfectly appropriate for you to give it. So there would have been something right and appropriate about that. But I didn't do it. And why didn't I do it? Because I didn't want to be a hindrance to you in listening to my message. As things turn out with the Corinthians, there is a crowd in Corinth that is almost constantly suspicious of Paul. They don't really click with Paul so much. So Paul is saying, I decided that I was not going to be a stumbling block in this situation. He doesn't explain what the problem would have been, but it's not hard to see what he's afraid of. That if he takes money from the Corinthians, that they would attribute to him the motives of, well, he's just in it for the money. Why is he here preaching this gospel? Because he wants us to pay him. That's why. The gospel to Paul is a means of livelihood. That's what it means to him. And in this situation, with a group that's pretty volatile and suspicious of him, he says, I'm just not going to take any money from you. We'll solve that problem. That's why I did it. Because I didn't want to get in the way of you being able to listen to the gospel. And I care about the gospel. What we have in the passage is Paul saying that I didn't take it, and his purpose was so that he would not be a hindrance to them in understanding the gospel. He does not explain what his taking the money might have hindered them hearing the gospel in. He doesn't explain there what the problem would have been. But now what I'm relying on is, we know when we look at the two letters that Paul wrote to the Corinthians that he has a very troubled relationship with them, and that many of them are suspicious of them, of him. Some of them don't even think that he's really an apostle. So in chapter 9 he doesn't say, I know you're suspicious of me and that's why I didn't take the money. But what I'm saying is, he chose not to take the money because he didn't want to cause a problem for them. And I'm saying it seems to me pretty obvious that the problem that he was afraid of is that if he took the money, they would see him as somehow being in it for the money. So perhaps it's another problem. He doesn't say what the problem would have been, but I think that makes the most sense. Okay. But the important idea here is that the reason that Paul chose not to take the money was he thought that if he took the money, he might end up being a stumbling block for the Corinthians in hearing him out. And then he explains, look, I'm not just a preacher as a job. It's not just that I have this obligation to preach the gospel because it's my job as an apostle. I am an individual who also has to believe the gospel and live out the gospel myself. How could I, on the one hand, preach the gospel and be determined that I'm going to lay out for you what the gospel is and convince you that you ought to follow it to your salvation, and yet do it in such a way that I'm going to make sure that I get paid, whether it makes it harder for you to listen to me or not? He's saying, how could I value the gospel personally and yet value money more highly than I do whether you get to hear the gospel? So, he's deliberately limiting his freedom. And he, in general, says, this is what I do. When I go out and preach the gospel, I limit my freedom. When I'm with Jews, I live as a Jew, which means there are things I don't eat and things I don't say and things I don't wear. And when I'm with Gentiles, then I conduct myself as a Gentile. I think about how I'm going to exercise my freedom in terms of how is it going to impact the people that I'm talking to. Is it going to get in the way of them being able to hear me whether I exercise this freedom or not? And so, Paul comes back around to tell the Corinthians, that is the model that I want you to follow when you're thinking about whether you're going to eat that meat sacrificed to idols or not. The question is not whether you have the freedom. Of course you have the freedom. The question is, what is the impact of your exercising that freedom going to be on other people? That's the question that you have to consider. So, when we follow Paul's argument in context, we can see that there's a different picture emerging than the one that I described before. First of all, Paul is not practicing the spiritual discipline of poverty. That is, he didn't sit down and say, you know, it would be good for me to have less money. I'm going to turn down my salary so that I can grow in holiness by having less money to deal with. That's not what he did. It's not a spiritual discipline that Paul was exercising. It's a moral one. That is, he saw himself under a moral obligation to use his freedom in such a way that it helped rather than hindered the Corinthians in hearing the gospel. So yes, he disciplined himself. He could have asked for money, but he didn't. He put a restriction on the way he lived his life. But it wasn't a religious restriction. It wasn't the idea that if I do this religious practice, it will make me more holy. It was a restriction that arose out of his understanding of the gospel and its implications. This is what I ought to do in this situation. If I don't do this, I will be doing wrong. And then secondly, the analogy that he makes about being the athlete in the race, he's not saying, I practice a religious discipline so that later on I can be holy and successful in obedience. His analogy is, I am like an athlete who is running a race to win the prize. He says, why are you in the race? You run the race because you want to win the prize. And what is the prize that he's talking about? I would argue that prize is eternal life. What he's saying is, I don't want to preach the gospel and then be disqualified myself. I want to believe the gospel that I'm preaching. I want to live out the implications of that gospel. I want to embrace it for myself. And so, I submit myself to limitations that are in keeping with what I've been called to do. When I'm with the Jews, I don't exercise my freedom to eat ham sandwiches because I care about the gospel. I myself want to live in a way that matches what I believe to be true. And likewise, you Corinthians, even though you have the right to eat that meat, you had better not exercise that right in such a way that you are causing other people to stumble. That would be a foolish and evil thing to do. Okay, so the points here that I'm making, first of all, to be biblical, as I would describe it, means that I try to put myself into the text, look at the argument in context, and see what is it that's on the author's mind. What is his issue? The particular writing on spiritual formation that I'm talking about, I would argue that although it was trying to be biblical, it ignored a great deal of the evidence in the text as to what was on Paul's mind. And so it ended up attributing to him motives and intentions that there's no evidence in the text that he has. Nothing in that text suggests that Paul is interested in the spiritual discipline of poverty. Everything suggests that Paul is interested in the moral discipline of limiting my freedom for the sake of others. Those are two very different things. Okay. And I would like to suggest in general that as we look for a biblical approach to spiritual formation, what is obedience and the pursuit of the spiritual life look like from a biblical perspective, this is a distinction that we need to keep in mind. This is a particularly clear example of it, but I would argue that I encounter this all the time. Arguments that are supposedly biblical, that appeal to a passage in the Bible, but they're trying to argue that some religious practice is the means to spirituality, when in fact, if you go in and actually look at what the issue is in the passage, the issue is something more fundamental, like believe the gospel, or obey God, or love your neighbor, or something like that, that we all have an obligation to pursue. So, in that example, I hope it's clear what I'm getting at. What we're looking for is a kind of biblical that is sensitive to what is it that the biblical author had on his mind. What was he trying to promote? My second example comes from the book of James. And I just want to step back and say a few things from the book of James. In order to do that, let me describe the situation into which James is writing. James is writing into a number of Jewish churches, Jewish believers in Christ scattered around the Mediterranean. He's hearing about what's happening in these places. Many of their members are relatively poor, and they are suffering at the hands of rich and powerful men. Wages are being withheld. Poor Christians are being taken into court by rich landowners. There's a lot of suffering going on in the churches that James is writing to. Now, what is the response of many of these Christians? They lust after money so that they can have an easier time of things. Those rich people couldn't be beating me up if I had money. They try to curry favor with the rich because the rich can help them along. And they ignore anyone poorer than themselves because what good is a poor person going to do me? They are ambitious and jealous. There's much backbiting and fighting going on among them, even to the point of murder. At one point, James has to say to them, "You adulteresses, don't you know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God?" There are a number of unspiritual, worldly people in these churches that James is writing to. James is writing into a problem situation with a group of people who are, not that this is true of everyone in these churches, but that there is a lot of just out and out ungodliness and worldliness happening in the congregations that he's writing to. What does James have to say to them? This ought to be a very interesting place to explore the question of spiritual formation. Because James talks a lot in his letter about the process of spiritual maturity. He's writing to incredibly spiritually immature people, and he's giving them advice. He's telling them what they ought to think. He's telling them what they ought to do. So this ought to be a rich place for us to look as we try to understand what would pursuing spiritual maturity look like. Now, I have both a positive and a negative point that I want to draw from James. I'm going to make the positive point in a minute. And that is, I think we have a very rich picture of the process of how James looks at spiritual maturity and what we ought to do about it. And so that's really going to provide the centerpiece of my comments about what biblical spiritual formation looks like. James is going to give us some real pointers on that. But there is kind of a negative point as well. Here we have James addressing exactly the situation that we are most interested in. How are you foolish, unspiritual people going to move to maturity? How is this going to happen? What should you do? What is this going to look like? And yet, we do not find James in this context telling people that what you need to do is fast and meditate and chant things, he does not prescribe for them religious practices as the solution to their problem. What he does tell them, we'll talk about in a minute. But I think this is incredibly significant. Now, I know you have to be careful with arguments from silence. Arguments from silence are dangerous. But arguments from silence are not invalid, from my perspective. You just have to be careful. But if in a situation that is all about a certain topic, a person who cares about it very much spells out what he thinks is involved and leaves out a whole bunch of stuff, the question legitimately arises, why is it that he didn't talk about that stuff, if that's the thing that's really going to help solve the problem? Now, I would say this really about the whole New Testament. When I read the apostles writing over and over again to churches where there are problems, immaturity, lack of faith, lack of understanding, they're telling them, here's how you ought to think about this. Here's what you ought to do. We don't find them saying, here are the religious practices you need to do that will help you get over this problem. What we find instead is the sort of thing that I'm about to describe James saying. I think, as strange as it might seem, James seeming like a very different book from Romans, say, or something like that, the fact is that all of the apostles say very similar things when it comes down to what is it that you need to know and do to pursue a life of spiritual maturity. It all pretty much comes down to the same thing. And it doesn't focus on religious practices when they talk about it. So, what do we find in James? Now, I have to acknowledge this is true in what I said about 1 Corinthians, and this is true in what I'm saying about James. The problem with having a little talk about a biblical approach to things is that we don't have time to actually defend that the Bible is actually saying this stuff. So all I can say is, for instance, if you're interested in 1 Corinthians and what's going on in that section, a month or so ago I taught a whole series of stuff on 1 Corinthians chapters 8, 9, and 10. So I would argue I'm prepared to make a case for why it is I think certain things are happening there. But I'm not going to make that case here. And the same thing is true in James. I'm just going to tell you what I think he's saying. And you have every right to say, well, yeah, but that, what if he's not saying that? What if he's saying something else? Well, absolutely, that's right. You need to check me out on this. And we have, I mean, if you're interested, I'm not promoting this, but if you're interested, there are tapes around of old series where I taught through James. Although that was a while ago, I don't know if I still believe that stuff. But I think I do, more or less. So that's one of the dangers about being a teacher and taping things as you go along. It comes back to haunt you. Okay, but here are a couple of key points that I want to make. I think this is incredibly important. This is, you know, if you've been snoozing up to now, I would just encourage you to try to stay awake for a couple minutes, because I think this is really important. Okay. Here's the deal. James knows that the churches are suffering in many ways. He describes various problems that they're encountering in his letter. But he reminds them that God sends what he calls trials into our lives to test our faith. There is a purpose for these difficulties that they're going through. And at least one of those purposes is to test their faith. And he says that these trials, this process of having our faith tested, is something to rejoice in. And I think there are two reasons why it's something to rejoice in. First of all, trials are a God-given opportunity for the reality of our faith to emerge. It's one thing to say, oh yeah, I believe that. It's another thing to discover in the midst of living out your life that you in fact do believe it. In fact, you believe it so much that even in the midst of difficulties, you hold tight to the gospel. You don't walk away and say, I don't want to have anything to do with this, it's too hard. You say, no, this is my hope. This is what my life is about. When I am facing pressure to abandon the faith and yet I persevere, then I have had an opportunity to see my heart expose itself a little bit in the real world. Many believers, including myself, could tell stories about times in their life when difficulties of one sort or another really forced them to confront the question, what do I believe? Do I believe in this God? I know I said I did when it didn't cost me a whole lot, but now there's something really at stake here. Is this really what I'm counting on? Is this really what I want my life to be about? Is it really worth it to follow a God who would call me down a path like this? An example from James. In their synagogues, we see that there were sometimes rich men that would come in. James describes these rich men as basically enemies of the faith. They persecute believers. They drag them into court. He says they blaspheme the fair name by which you've been called. And also into their synagogues, poor people would come in. People that are even poorer than the rest of the folks in the congregation. How are we going to respond to this? The world would tell me, the rich man can do you a lot of good. You'd better make sure that you treat him well. The poor man, he's kind of a social embarrassment. I don't even want the rich guy to notice that we have a guy like this around here, because this may queer the whole deal. We don't want to do that. So let's kind of try to keep the poor guy, you know, over here out of the way. This makes sense. If the bottom line is, what I need is to find a way to solve my financial problems now. I need to make sure that I have the approval of people with power and wealth. Then it makes sense for me to toady to the rich guy and to ignore the poor guy. It makes sense to do that, because that's going to be in my best interest. But what if the gospel is true? What if in fact there is a God, and that God has called out a people to inherit eternal life, to live with a richness of life that we can hardly imagine? The problem of sin is gone, the problem of death is gone, the problem of futility is gone. And the people who inherit that richness forever are the people who have faith, the people who put their trust in God. Now, how do these two look to me? The rich unbeliever is actually poor, because he's going to lose everything he has one day. I know it looks good now, but he can't keep it. And if he won't put his trust in God, then he has nothing. He's going to end up with nothing. The poor believer here, on the other hand, is rich. He has the one thing that is the ticket to a wealth that you cannot lose. He has faith. If I am a person of faith, if I believe the gospel, then I look at these two people, and it is the poor guy who is my soulmate. He is my fellow traveler. He and I are in this together. We're looking for the same hope. And unfortunately, as attractive as the wealth of the rich guy is, the fact that he's not interested in that hope means that he and I are not in this together. Unfortunately, the people that James is writing to have taken the wrong road. He describes them as saying to the rich man, oh, here, you come sit in a good seat, and to the poor guy, here, you go over here, sit at my feet, or go in the back, someplace where I don't have to look at you. That's what they're doing. What James is saying to them in this letter is, this is a trial. This is a spot where you're being tested as to what does this stuff mean to you. You have to decide whether the gospel is true. If the gospel is true, it is that poor believer who is your brother. If the gospel is not true, then it is the rich unbeliever who is your possible benefactor. But it can't be both ways. One or the other of those things is true. So what are you going to do? How are you going to respond in this situation? So it's one of those rubber meets the road situations where it could really cost them to embrace the poor believer and not to sort of try to curry favor with the rich guy, they might end up losing in this world something that they really want. But they haven't lost anything that's really worth trying to keep, if the gospel's true. So James is telling them, look, that's what's going on. Yeah, I know you went forward and said you believe this stuff, but now you're in that spot where you're actually finding out whether you do believe it, whether it actually is what you want your life to be about. And he reminds them that there is great joy in actually struggling through and persevering in faith in the midst of the trials of my faith. To actually persevere and in the end see the reality of what God is doing in my life is a great thing. And I would point out that Paul teaches exactly the same thing in Romans. Peter teaches exactly the same thing in 1 Peter. This is a common theme that ultimately what's inside is going to make its way out in the midst of my life. It's going to be tested. And this is from God, and it's a good thing. The other reason that James gives that they should rejoice in these trials is particularly relevant to our topic here this morning. God uses these trials, he says, to mature our faith. It actually is the process of wrestling with, what do I believe? What do I want? What am I going to do in the midst of the trials of life? It is in those places where I make real strides in the maturity of my faith. I'm wrestling with the big questions. Is God good? Is he really there? Is this gospel all it's cracked up to be? Is that what I want? If I can wrestle through some real situation in life and come to the conclusion, yes, in fact, this is what I want. I do think God is there, and I am counting on him for life ultimately. Then I have learned something. It's not just a thing that I have said with my mouth, but it is an idea that I have wrestled with in my heart, and I have made progress. I have come to a conclusion. Yes, this is for me. This is what I want. And I believe that in a number of places, the Bible paints this picture that there are those times when in the middle of great struggle, sometimes after a long period of struggle, that by the grace of God, I win through to a strong conviction that yes, the gospel is for me. This is in fact what I'm counting on. And that process can lead to a maturity of my faith. That from now on, from that point on, life doesn't look to me quite the same. I will still have many struggles and trials. My problems are far from over and I'm still weak in many ways. But I did wrestle with and settle a big issue for myself. I'm not the same person I was before. I know from talking to people that there are many people in this room who would testify that that has happened to them in their experience with God. That they went through a very messy and difficult time. And oftentimes, I often hear people use this language, the language that I would use myself. Something like, I came this close to telling God to shove it, but I didn't. And the fact that I didn't made all the difference. Because now, when I said, God, I'm with you, I knew something about what I was saying. I knew something about what it was that I was believing in. I didn't know when I went forward what I was getting myself into. But now I have a little bit of an idea of what I'm getting myself into, and I still want it. Now I'm starting to come to a place where my faith is mature. So I see the New Testament. James describes this. Many places in the New Testament describe this. This is the curriculum that God has designed for his children. Hebrews talks about how if you're a legitimate child of God, you're going to be disciplined. And hey, discipline isn't fun. But afterwards, it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. So, I see James saying what I see all the apostles saying. Spiritual growth fundamentally is something that is brought about by God on the inside through the Spirit, and it manifests itself most strikingly in life in the midst of those things that really test our faith. That real spiritual maturity often results from persevering in my faith in the midst of those difficulties. Okay, so What do I do now? I look at my life and, you know, I'm one of James' readers, and I say, boy, you know, it's not been good. James has really convicted me here. I've been a fool. I've been toadying to these rich people. I've been ambitious and fighting and greedy, and I've forgotten. I've lost track of what's really important. I've been a fool. I feel so weak. I don't know. It's so hard to keep going. I mean, to find the spiritual strength to do this stuff. What should I do? Well, what does James say? He's talking to people that have a real problem. What does he tell them in this letter? Well, he tells them a number of things, but I would point to a few important things that he tells them. First of all, he tells them to pray for help. He tells them to look to God to transform their foolishness into wisdom. Remembering that God is forgiving and He is willing and able to change me. God can solve my problem in this way. He is able to move me from folly to wisdom. Now, James, probably many of you are familiar that James says we should pray for wisdom. I would argue that that is not a statement that says you should pray to God that He would tell you His will for your life. It's not the key to finding God's will. That's not what James is talking about. He's talking about arriving at wisdom, which, as he describes it, is a moral quality. I am no longer a fool, as so many of the people he's writing to have been, but they have arrived at wisdom. He's saying, pray to God for that. God is generous. He does not reproach. He knows that you have been a fool, but He's not going to reproach you for that. He is generous and will grant the wisdom that you ask for. So, if I find myself longing to mature spiritually, one of the things James says is cry out to God. Ask Him to give you wisdom. I would like to say from personal experience that I believe God answers the cry for wisdom. I also believe that sometimes He does not answer it quickly. I mean, this is no proof of anything, it's just me, but I would describe myself as a person who genuinely, at a point in my life, from the heart, cried out in agony to God for wisdom. And I believe that He granted that prayer. I don't mean that I'm a big wise guy now, but I mean, you know, that I moved from a real confusion and spiritual weakness to actually having a little content and stability to my faith. And that process took a long time. But I believe He answered the prayer. I absolutely believe that my cry to Him for wisdom was answered. But it wasn't a particular technique, and it didn't go very fast. Another thing that James says, this is what you need to do. You need to persevere in believing. You need to keep on hanging on to the gospel. You can't get around it. You face a choice. Will I believe this or not? Do I believe that God is there, that He is able to do what I am asking Him to do? That He will keep the promises that He has made? That this is worth pursuing? I have to do that. That's the task that's in front of me. To keep believing. As the temptations come, as the pressures mount, I may fail and I may falter. It can even get pretty bad. James is talking to people who look really ugly at this point. It can get very ugly. It's not that it may not get ugly, but ultimately, you have to hang in there. That's what he tells them to do. Real faith is a spark that cannot be blown out. So, hang in there. And a lot of his advice in that letter is basically of the keep trusting in God variety. He tells them to remind themselves of and to embrace the truth. He reminds them of things. How he's trying to help them by reminding them, this is what's true. Look, the gospel makes you rich and otherwise you're poor. Live your life like a farmer waiting for the harvest, because God will come and fulfill His promises. He reminds them what the truth is of their situation and saying, remember this, think about this. Live your life as if this were true. He urges them to embrace the Word of God in this process. Listen to the proclamation of the gospel, the Word. It should be implanted, he says. And I think the idea is that I am taking it in and actually letting it take root in my life. It's not just something I hear. He's very big on, don't just be a hearer of this stuff, but take it in and live it. Decide that it is true, and then take the next step. And that's the final piece of advice, I think, that he gives them. Live out your faith. Remember what is true, and then, as you take your next step in life, do what makes sense in the light of the gospel. The gospel says that the poor believer is rich, so stop treating the poor like dirt. The gospel says that the rich unbeliever has nothing, so stop being jealous of him. The gospel says that God is providing you with the true riches, so stop fighting and killing each other in your jealous battles for power and position. That's what the gospel says to me. If the gospel is true, I've been wrong. I have done what is stupid and foolish because I have been living a lie. I've been acting as if this were true, and it's not. This is what's true. For all of us, I think, the message of the New Testament is, do you believe that you are a sinner, that Christ has brought you mercy, that Christ will give you eternal righteousness and life, that nothing in this world is more valuable than what Christ is doing for you? Do you believe that? Then live as if it were true. Confess your sins. Pursue the love of God and man. Don't love the wealth of the world. Remind each other of these truths often. Tell yourselves again and again what's really going on. And pray to God for help, that you could be strong and that you could see what's true. So, in conclusion then, to what I've been trying to say here, what do I mean by a biblical approach to spiritual formation? I mean carefully seeking to find the points that the author means to make in context and drawing implications that legitimately derive from what they are saying. And I mean putting the emphasis where the Bible puts the emphasis. It's very hard for me to believe that religious practices are the key to spirituality when I don't find the New Testament prescribing religious practices as the problem for unspiritual people. And what is then the biblical picture of spiritual formation? God's Spirit is at work making us people who can see and embrace the gospel. God is using trials to test the reality of those new eyes and hearts so that we can see the evidence of the change that He is working. He is also using trials to mature our faith, to bring us to important decisions to trust God that from then on change the way we think and act. Meanwhile, what we are called upon to do, where we are right now, wherever we are in the journey of faith right now, we are called upon to look to God, to pray for Him for His help, to persevere in believing and holding on to the gospel, to remind ourselves of the truths of the gospel through teaching, through study of the Bible. And at the present moment, as I go to make my next move, live out my faith as best I know how. That's what the Bible would say is the way to become a spiritual person. I think that's a pretty fair summary of the biblical view of spiritual formation. Believe the gospel, trust God, and seek to live the next moment of your life as if the gospel were true.